on air, online,
on digital,
and the ABC Listen app. The Country Hour with Tony Briscoe on ABC Radio Hobart and ABC Northern Tasmania.
Coming up today, solar panels creating energy and protecting the fruit at One Orchard.
That was sort of our starting point with an interest in looking at solar panels above the trees, was to deliberately try to shade the trees and the fruit at certain times of the day when they're more susceptible to sunburn.
And will the brides wear a dress made solely from wool?
I think they are, because the world's changing. So I think people are looking for sustainable, eco-friendly fabrics that work well, that break down. And this is one beautiful thing about the beautiful fibre, is that it will go back into the ground to grow more grass, to grow more wool.
The bridal dress made from wool to wear year-round. That story coming up. And also the solar panels coming in handy to create energy and protect the fruit from sunburn. That story very shortly. G'day, Tony, with you on this. The last day of March, Friday the 31st. That means Richard Bailey will be along later to check the latest Powerana Wiener sale, where we've seen some of the best prices of the autumn sales so far. Also today, the Crawford Fund hosting a food forum at Government House in Hobart. We'll take you there a little bit later in the program, find out what's happening there. Plus a check on the weather and your thoughts on any issues via the text line. 0438 922 936 is that number, 0438 922 936. First up, the apple harvest. And Australians eat on average around 10 kilos of apples a year. It's just over one apple a week. The most popular apple is the Pink Lady. And one Tasmanian organic grower is hoping his new variety will grab market share, with Tasmanian apple growers looking to reap the benefits of other states' climatic misfortunes. Organic grower Andrew Smith hopes his new variety, Southern Bliss, will be a winner with consumers. He spoke to Fiona Breen at the Rookwood Orchard in the Huon Valley.
We're really excited today to be doing our first commercial harvest of the Southern Bliss apple. Southern Bliss is a trademark variety of which we had the commercial license to produce and market in Australia. And we're into the apples today that you'll see on the shelves mid this year.
So a lot of work's gone into this.
So this orchard that you're standing in now was planted in 2019. And we purchased the commercial license in 2016 in Belgium. So this is a long 7-year plan already. And this is our first commercial harvest.
Why go to the trouble of starting a new apple variety in Australia?
So it doesn't matter whether it's apples or berries or bananas at the moment. The name of the game in agriculture is to have trademark varieties where you actually own the DNA and you get some commercial license holding of those, and then license growers and try and organise them to help with the selling process and the price structure in a very oversupplied market.
Well, you mentioned oversupplied market. It has been a bit tough in apples with prices and oversupply. You're hoping to break through with this one?
We are. I mean, the real breakthrough for us will be if consumers actually like this product and come and rebuy. That is the test of any variety or any product, really, is the consumer demand. Apples, produce and fruit all over the world, apart from climatic conditions and geopolitical risk, is generally oversupplied.
But still worthwhile. It's a big commitment, a big financial commitment to do this too, isn't it?
Unfortunately, Fiona, it's what we do. We're generational farmers, and our intellectual property and the tools that we have in our toolbox are to produce fruit and hopefully produce it well and commercialise it and sell it in the market, and that's what we do. If I was a lawyer or a doctor, I'd probably make more money.
How many growers would you say go to this effort to start up new varieties now?
There are a number of new apple varieties that are going to hit the Australian market over the next 3 to 5 years, and that's only exciting for the consumer because, in my opinion, they've all been selected because they either have better storability, better flavour, look better, have all the characteristics that make a better product than a cardboard-tasting old Red Delicious or Golden Delicious, which brews really easily in the market.
Can we take on more varieties?
Ultimately, the consumer decides who wins and who loses in any field, and I'm hoping that the characteristics of this apple win over the consumer. I'll worry about the rest tomorrow.
How do you take on a new patent, and what's the process? It's quite complex and costly.
Absolutely. It involves ultimately buying the commercial licence. First of all, building some confidence in the variety, enough confidence to actually write out a cheque and invest in the variety. I did that overseas. Then you have to bring it through quarantine, do tissue culture, multiply the nursery trees, get them to orchard, produce some commercial volumes of fruit, which we start today, 7 years later, and then have enough confidence to endorse this to another apple grower and get them to put their money on the line. So it's a huge process.
How much money have you put into this?
A substantial amount of money. I'd hate to think. I can't tell you right now because my father might hear.
And you'll try and get other growers to take it on?
Absolutely. What we're about today and what we're excited about today is first giving this to the consumer in the middle of this year. We have an exclusive arrangement with Woolworths for selling the product, but we're excited about getting it to the consumer. We're also very excited to show this to other fruit growers and hopefully get them to take up the commercial opportunity.
What does it taste like?
It's firm, it's high Brix, but it's not sweet.
What does that mean?
It means it's got incredibly high Brix level, 16 Brix as opposed to a Gala, which is 14, but I wouldn't classify it as very sweet tasting. So it has a unique taste profile. You'd have to taste it to find out, but it has incredible storability. So it will keep in your fridge for 3 or 4 months. And that's one of the traits that's made it very attractive for us. And the first thing that turns any consumer off is an apple that's soft.
Okay, so the consumer can actually keep it in their fridge.
Absolutely. So it doesn't bruise easily and it keeps well in the fridge, which means that ultimately once it's purchased, it's consumed. Food wastage is a huge problem globally and it's something that people are concentrating on and working on globally. And so this is a product that won't go off easily and you're more likely to consume after you've spent your money. Very juicy. I love the flavour. It's obviously, I'm biased. Yeah, I love it. It's beautiful. Has a thin skin. It's attractive. 50% of its parentage is golden delicious. So you can see in the yellow flesh in the back is where the golden comes out. The red is its other parent in the US. The other thing about this apple is it's a low input apple. So we can produce this with low inputs and we think the consumer wants an apple in the end with less inputs, not more.
What about price? How will you go with that? How will it figure in the market?
Pricing, there is a limit to how much you can charge for fruit in Australia. It's around $6 or $7 retail per kilo for product. And we will have to work, and the responsibility of our business is to operate within those limits. But this will be at the higher end of the market, along with Jazz and Envy and those other new varieties on the market.
Pink Lady is the most popular variety at 37% of the volume purchased, followed by Gala at 21% and Granny Smith at 13%. Another 23% of apple buyers are buying a mix of new ones like Envy and old favourites like Golden Delicious. Now Southern Bliss will be in the mix. It could be a good year for Tasmanian apples. With floods and hailstorms in apple-growing areas across mainland Australia affecting supplies. Scott Price is president of Fruit Growers Tasmania.
I think we'll be up. Packouts will be high. And hopefully later on in the season, the market will reward the growers for their effort.
Do you think you've had problems with prices in the past? How do you think you'll go this year?
Look, it's always very difficult. We do rely very much on the duopoly of Woolworths and Coles, but in fairness to them, they do a reasonable job in our area. And I think hopefully as we get towards the middle of the year, a lot of the fruit from the mainland that was probably knocked around by some of the climatic conditions will have cleared the market, and the rewards for good quality fruit will appear.
Don't think there'll be an oversupply?
I don't think there'll be oversupply of Class 1 fruit this year, no.
Actually, Tassie might do quite well because of another state's misfortune.
We used to always say that the apple industry used to survive on another state's misfortune. That's not so true anymore because volume of apples are quite high in Australia now. But fingers crossed, I think this season is going to be pretty good for Tasmanian apples.
Scott Price, President of Fruit Growers Tasmania, and before that we heard organic grower Andrew Smith talking about the first harvest of the new variety Southern Bliss, which he hopes will be a winner with consumers. Now, if you go to our ABC Rural online page, you'll see a story on the new apple and pictures of the Southern Bliss. Well, we all love a good-looking piece of fruit, but one issue many growers face is protecting apples and pears from sunburn. With this problem in mind, researchers at Agriculture Victoria have been experimenting by putting solar panels above pear trees to provide shade. Panels offer protection from the weather but also generate renewable energy. The idea of using solar in farming systems has been seen before with sheep grazing. However, this is the first solar orchard trial in the country. So far, with mixed results, Annie Brown spoke to research project leader Ian Goodwin at the Tatura Smart Farm.
Yeah, the orchard we're in at the moment is a block of pears, a fresh market pear that is marketed under the name of Lanya. It's a blush pear, in other words, it's got a orangey red foreground colour. So really important, because it's a fresh market pear, is that the quality meets, you know, consumers' satisfaction. And of course, one of those is, you know, it needs to be attractive. But one of the problems is sunburn. In other words, if there's excessive radiation hitting the fruit, it can actually get sunburned, as is the case with, you know, apples, for example, as well. That was sort of our starting point with an interest in looking at solar panels above the trees, was to deliberately try to shade the trees and the fruit at certain times of the day when they're more susceptible to sunburn.
And so you've had them in for a few years now, is that right? And have seen some early results so far?
Yeah, so we just finished our second season. It was a bad season because of the hail. We had a significant hail event here on the 22nd of December, just before Christmas last year. You know, any orchard that didn't have nets above it just got destroyed from the hail event. But it did show that the solar panels can at least partly protect the fruit from damage from hail, basically confounding the results, that hail damage. So sure, we could measure that there was some benefits in terms of protecting the fruit from hail, but all of those other advantages in terms of colour and or sunburn damage and even yield, that, you know, those results were really useless. The previous season, we were able to, you know, collect some pretty good data, and we definitely no sunburn whatsoever under the panels, compared to the control. But what we did find is a slight reduction in fruit size. We did see less colour development. You know, our thoughts are now is that the amount of panels we've got above these trees, they basically cover about 50% on a tree itself. 50% of that tree would be shaded from the solar panel. So we think that that's probably excessive.
So almost too shaded.
Yeah, that's right. Too shaded. Yes, yeah. Yes. And sure, we're here at the moment and it is sunny right now, but, you know, if you come here in January, you know, mid-January, it's actually quite pleasant to stand in under here, because there is quite a bit of shade, yeah.
Mm. Have you had much interest from growers around this technology and incorporating this into an orchard?
Yeah, there is a bit of interest. They're hesitant at the moment because of the cost of setting up the supporting structure. You know, the engineering behind and the structure to hold these panels up is pretty extensive and therefore expensive. But, you know, we think that we retrofitted this orchard with the solar panels. So if you were establishing an orchard right from the word go, you know, you'd be building the infrastructure to support the panels as well as the supporting structure for the trees. You know, one grower from up at Cobram was particularly enthusiastic. He recognised the benefits he could get from protecting crops that he was growing, not all of them, just certain ones, as well as obviously, you know, generating electricity.
Mm. What about, has there been any interest from solar farms?
Yeah, that's a good question. There's a lot of interest overseas, but the big solar companies in Australia, who we're actually working with on another project, they haven't shown a lot of interest in doing it anything within an orchard system. But in Europe, you know, we're working with a research institute in Germany, that they are very interested, or they are working with commercial companies over there to look at solar in orchards, you know, not necessarily just pear orchard, but other orchards as well.
Do you see this as something that we could see in the future for orchards? More of this? Solar panels in rows?
Yeah, I think as the technology gets better and better, you know, definitely it's something that we'd consider. I mean, you know, you'd recommend nearly all orchards would have netting above the trees, not only to protect against hail, but to protect against, you know, excessive radiation. So the question then becomes is how can you design solar into that, you know, netting system? And as the technology gets not only cheaper but lighter, rather than the solar panels, you know, the plastic type solar panels, you know, you could easily perhaps be integrating them into a netting system so that, you know, basically the nets were solar panels. It's really just a, you know, the start of hopefully a lot more work in this area of agrivoltaics. I think it's what's quite exciting from us is, you know, we're basically plant physiologists, so it's exciting from that angle. But also, I think, you know, in the future, with the, as the technology gets better, it could easily be part of a orchard system.
Ian Goodwin, research leader at the Tatura Smart Farm, speaking there to Annie Brown about placing the solar panels above the pear trees to protect the pears from sunburn. Coming up on the Country Hour, woolen bridal dresses and an unfortunate death of a horse at a rodeo at the weekend. Plus later in the program, we'll take you to Government House, where there's a forum on from the Crawford Fund.
Drive. Teen Challenge Tasmania
with Kylie Baxter
is behind this latest offering to Lottie's Cafe Scene.
Keeping you entertained.
There's different courses that people could do.
And informed.
But they don't actually get real life training. I love people that just show up, you know, a bit of go in them to give it a crack. I believe in giving people a shot.
On air, online, on digital and the ABC Listen app. Kylie Baxter this afternoon from 4 p.m. on ABC Radio Hobart.
It's the Country Hour with Tony Briscoe on ABC Radio Hobart and ABC Northern Tasmania.
Oh 4 3 8 9 2 2 9 3 6 is our text line number. A horse death at the Preston Rodeo over the weekend was a freak accident, according to the event's animal welfare officer, Gary King. Our reporter, Meg Powell, spoke to Mr. King about the incident.
So, yes, we had an incident with the horse at the rodeo where he came out of the chutes. Our arena surface was excellent condition there. It's worked up perfectly. The horse just left the chutes and bucked across the arena, which dismounting his rider in the process and lost his foot, just sort of stumbled at some stage or at that stage of the ride, which initially his head went into the ground and breaking his neck instantly. Our vet was there within 30 seconds of the incident. We had Hessian bags, which we carry for every rodeo with an ambulance we have. So everything was all done in protocol and procedures of the APRA. So we had everything in line. And Jim arrived at the horse within 30 seconds, pronouncing the horse was dead straight away. So, and then we went on with our procedures of removing the horse from the arena, and all our things was all clarified with the APRA. We would do stock and animal incident reports. So that was the main part of it.
Gary, are you confident that all the necessary safety precautions were taken?
Yes, I am confident. Extremely confident that all our procedures was intact. Like I said, we had our Hessian. The animals are in the greatest of condition. They looked absolutely unreal. They do 6 rodeos a year. They do 8 seconds work a year. So if you work that out, it's a lot less than a riding horse gets. They get looked after at a Birralee place at Birralee there. They stock and fed well. Everything is, they own top line, these horses. They're athletes. And it's just a freak accident that happens. Which happens in the paddock at home or anything like that. It was just a freak accident.
You call it a freak accident. How often do these sorts of things happen?
Oh, look, in Australia, We have probably about 65 rodeos in Australia every year. These accidents are very limited to any horse that's used in any sort of competition. Freak accidents do happen. It's like someone driving a car, if you know what I mean. It's just freak accidents happen, and we just have to learn to get on with things, I think.
Rodeos certainly have their critics. Some might say it was unnecessary for that horse to be there in the first place, putting its safety at risk for the sake of a sport. How would you respond to that?
Yeah, just like I said there in the previous comments, these horses are athletes themselves. They have not got a lot of other choices in life. They are usually horses that have been, I would say, not bad horses, but horses that have usually liked to buck people off. And there's the other alternative for these horses is not really a better one either. So these horses have got second chance in life to perform and do things that they like to do, so which is buck.
So to clarify, you're saying the alternative for them really is euthanasia?
Yes. Most of these horses would be euthanized if they wasn't in a rodeo or thing. And I mean, these horses are very well looked after. They are treated like families. And yes, that's about all I can say on that question. And I just want to add that we handled the matter, as I've said in a previous statement there, that we handled the matter professionally, in a proper manner. I myself, as a judge and an animal welfare officer, I take my job very seriously, very, very seriously. As we can say, we're on the radio talking about it now. I think we've handled it very extremely well. We had a vet on hand, as all rodeos in Australia do, have a vet on hand. The animal was not euthanized because it was already dead within 30 seconds of the event happening. And we handled the situation properly and extremely professionally, I would say.
Will this affect the way you do rodeos going forward?
Well, not really, I don't say. I would not say that it will affect rodeos. It is a freak accident, like I said, that happens in any event, anywhere in the world, in any situation, whether it be livestock, humans, or anything.
Tasmania's Rodeo Animal Welfare Officer Gary King talking there to Meg Powell about the horse death at the Preston Rodeo last weekend and describing it as a freak accident. To wool now. Wool is used in many things we wear these days, but have you ever seen a wedding dress made out of wool? One very persistent South Australian bridal designer is determined to take the fibre all the way to the altar. And as Landlines Kerry State discovered, her backyard provides plenty of inspiration.
At Adelaide Fashion Week, a rural woman is taking a bold step. In amongst the state's well-known couture names like Paolo Sebastian, designer Nikki Atkinson has launched a new bridal label, Horrocks Vale. And all of her wedding dresses are made out of wool.
It can be mixed with laces, it can be mixed with beading. You know, we can create some beautiful dresses and make them look like any other wedding dress, but it's wool.
As a kid, Nikki spent more time trying to get out of wool than into it.
I remember having a little pinafore when I was probably 7 or 8. And all I can remember is it was thick, heavy and scratchy and itchy, and I didn't like it.
But the designer, who grew up on a farm, does have some fond memories of the fibre.
I'd have to say when I first fell in love with wool was probably as a kid jumping in bales, you know, at shearing time and things like that, because it was fun. It was loads of fun. But as a fabric, yes, it was certainly fashion school that I absolutely fell in love with it then. It is better than any other fibre that I have worked with. It's better than silks, your rayons. It's just so much easier. It's pliable. It tends to want to drape well. It's easier to sew. I haven't found any other fibre like this.
Her passion for the fibre only intensified when she married a wool grower and moved to their sheep property in the Flinders Ranges.
Yeah, when I get the sheep off the hill here, I'll be up behind them then.
While Dallas Lines is happy to stick to growing the wool, He is excited to see his wife take the industry he loves in a new direction.
People say, that's really nice. What's that made out of? It's wool. Really? And that might stir things up.
After running a bridal boutique in Adelaide for 8 years, these days Nikki runs her design business out of Port Augusta. But until recently, her dream to design the ultimate woolly outfit, which started 2 decades ago, remained out of reach.
When a girlfriend of mine was passionate about wool, came off of a wool merino property north of Broken Hill, and she wanted a wool wedding dress. We couldn't find ivory wool. We could find suiting fabrics. We could find other, you know, black, white, like navies, very general colours, but we just could not find ivory wool.
But last year, on a girls' trip to Melbourne, she stumbled across a wool supplier who made her day.
He had everything and I just fell in love then and there, and I just was so excited that I couldn't believe that this was something that happened, it's giving me goosebumps, something that happened 20 odd years ago and it was finally something that I'd found.
How does it feel?
Yeah, it feels really good actually.
Feels good?
Yeah.
And so began her quest to not just create glamorous gowns but also educate people on the versatility of wool across all seasons.
It's actually really breathable. It's, yeah, nice and light and
nice
soft.
And light, yeah.
When you say to people, yeah, I've got a wedding dress collection made out of wool, what's the reaction been so far?
It's good for winter. That'd be great for winter. And I say, no, not winter.
Are people ready for woolen wedding dresses?
I think they are. I think they are because the world's changing. So I think people are looking for sustainable, eco-friendly fabrics that work well, that break down. And this is one beautiful thing about the beautiful fibre is that it will go back into the ground to grow more grass, to grow more wool.
And for more on Nikki and another designer shaking up the wool industry, check out Landline this Sunday at 12:30 on ABC TV, or you can catch up on iView, of course. The report from Kerry State. Coming up, we'll take you to Government House in Hobart for the Food Forum from the Crawford Fund. And also Richard Bailey checks the livestock markets and we'll have a look at the weather as well. First up, the news headlines with Ellie Ward.
Thanks, Tony. Tasmania's announced it will be the first Australian state to extend its cancer compensation legislation, meaning firefighters will be automatically eligible if they're diagnosed with 8 additional cancers. Under landmark legislation introduced in 2013, firefighters are automatically covered if they contract 12 different types of cancer without having to prove they contracted it while on the job. After pressure from the United Firefighters Union, Workplace Safety Minister Elise Archer announced the state government will add 8 new cancers to the presumptive cancer list. The Tasmanian Premier says he'd consider a separate inquiry into live baiting in the greyhound racing industry if there's enough evidence. Independent MP Christy Johnston yesterday told Parliament that whistleblowers are reporting live rabbits and guinea pigs being used to bait greyhounds for racing. The former US President Donald Trump has reacted angrily to news that he's been indicted in connection with a hush money investigation. And the federal government has made its minimum wage submission to the Fair Work Commission, recommending it ensures real wages of low-paid workers don't go backwards. Full bulletin at 1.
Time now to check the latest on the weather. Luke Johnston joins us from the Bureau. G'day, Luke.
Hey, Tony. How are you going?
Pretty good. The transitioning phase for the weather from pretty ordinary to pretty good. Is that happening?
Yeah, that's a fair statement, I think. It's certainly a lot simpler today than it was yesterday. It turned out pretty nasty about some parts of the East Coast. So I think the lower part of the East Coast got hit the hardest with the winds yesterday, and then the upper part of the East Coast got some pretty steady but consistent rain. Ended up with around 23 millimetres in the gauge to 9 a.m. At St Helens at the aerodrome there. Fingal had about 18 millimetres, so the rain reached a little bit inland, but most other areas of Tasmania that saw rainfall was sort of less than around 5 millimetres or so yesterday. It was a pretty interesting day for St Helens, Tony. They only reached 11.9 degrees, which makes it the coldest March day reported at the airport there, at least for the records that go back 23 years.
Really?
Would have been a bit of a yucky day. Their minimum temperature was 11, and they rose to 11.9. And that's still colder than Hobart's overnight low last night of about 12 degrees.
Yeah, so, they would have been rummaging for the winter woolies. the yug
boots. That's right. Obviously not the the woolen wedding dresses that
no.
we're hearing about.
No.
No, they're not good for the winter, I hear.
No, but the good thing, Luke, the good thing is apparently most farmers out there got what we call the autumn break, which they were waiting for.
Oh, nice. So the break in the weather?
The rain, yeah.
Yeah, the rain. Yeah, oh, that's good.
Yeah.
Well, that's good. I'm glad there's happy people out there. For the rest of today, though, we're seeing some light showers coming to the west of the state. They're moving over the southeast at the moment, and we'll likely see those showers develop over most parts of Tasmania during the remainder of this afternoon. Less likely about the northwest coast, where there's a bit of a rain shadow happening. In terms of rainfall amounts today, don't expect more than about a millimetre or two, unless you're in the west. If you're in the west, you get 5 to 10, but everywhere else, sort of 1 to 2 millimetres at most. And going forward into the weekend, we'll see the trend of essentially light showers continuing into the west and far south at times, but remaining fine Saturday, Sunday and Monday about all northern and eastern parts of Tasmania. Something to be mindful of, though, is that the next couple of mornings are likely to be quite chilly. So tomorrow morning inland, particularly about the Midlands and adjacent sort of inland areas, could see minimum temperatures around 2 degrees or so. So touching on a little bit above freezing, but pretty close to freezing. So no frost warnings likely, but it's probably quite close to needing one for this time of the year.
Hang on. Aren't we still in autumn?
Yeah, I know, right? It's also April Fool's Day tomorrow, but I'm not joking. I wish I was. I know. I'm disappointed that it's not April Fool's Day today and then we could have a bit of fun with it. But first day of April tomorrow, I believe. March, April, that's how it goes.
Okay.
Yeah, so...
And I'm just thinking, you know, you mentioned the woolen bridal dress. It's fairly logical because the best men's suits, most blokes wear a suit to their wedding, are made from wool, aren't they?
Oh, are they?
Yeah.
Oh, I don't know. It was 16 degrees on my wedding day, so I just wore a shirt. It was too hot to have a jacket on.
You just wore a shirt.
It does make me wonder. Maybe you could have. Yeah, just for the photos.
Yeah.
No, it does make me wonder, though, if you could get woolen suspenders or something like that, or that'd probably be no good because they might stretch.
That's it.
Yeah.
Now, have we got any warnings?
So we've still got a few wind warnings around the coasts. So a strong wind warning for all coastal waters apart from the far northwest coast and Bank Strait and Franklin Sound. Also for strong winds pushing into the southeast inshore waters apart from the Derwent Estuary. And that's really on the tail end of the system we had yesterday. It's gradually decreasing. We also have a minor flood warning current for the South Esk River. That's still going after yesterday's rainfall. It's likely to be finalised shortly. We saw rises at Lewis Hill on the St Paul's River. It didn't quite get to minor, but it was within a matter of centimetres. And Fingal was the other one we were watching, but it didn't quite rise that high. So hopefully no more flooding to think of for the next several days. Having said that, if you are looking for rainfall, it does look like we'll have an interesting system towards the end of next week, potentially going into the Easter long weekend with an interesting looking rain band about northern and eastern Tasmania, potentially Friday or Saturday next week. But
Obviously
that's 7 or 8 days away, but something to think about if you're thinking about heading away.
You've just put all the people off camping that were going to go camping, but anyway.
I've saved some terrible camping trips.
Yeah, true. For the weekend water warriors, what's happening on the coastal waters and swell?
Well, like with the weather, everything's sort of easing back this weekend at least. So southwesterly winds over the waters today, 20 to 30 knots. A little bit lighter tomorrow, 15 to 25 knots, tending westerly 10 to 20 knots during the afternoon and evening. Although early tomorrow morning, we'll still have winds reaching 30 knots about the east coast and at times throughout tomorrow about the southeast. In terms of swell, today, tomorrow, the southwesterly 2 to 2.5 to 4 metres today, tomorrow. Through Bass Strait, a confused to 1 metre today, tending a bit more westerly tomorrow. And up the east coast, a 1.5 to 2.5 metre south to southwesterly swell. Significant wave height on the west coast has rocketed up in recent hours to 3.7 metres. And on the east coast, it is around 2.5 metres. So back to normal conditions, Tony, with bigger waves in the west and the east.
Beauty. Thank you, Luke.
Thank you.
Luke Johnston there from the Bureau with the latest details for you on the weather. We've got Richard Bailey coming up with the latest power runner weaner sale. The Hereford cattle are the main attraction there, and they got some good money there too. But in just a moment, we'll take you to Government House in Hobart for a food forum.
This week on Landline, how about walking down the aisle in a woolly wedding dress.
We can create some beautiful dresses and make them look like any other wedding dress, but it's wool.
And restoring oyster reefs.
There's absolutely no doubt that they're working, they're recruiting shellfish, and they're also supporting an abundance of marine life.
That's Landline Sunday, 12:30 on ABC TV and streaming on ABC iView.
Coast to Coast. This is the Country Hour with Tony Briscoe on ABC Radio Hobart and ABC Northern Tasmania.
Now, the Crawford Fund is hosting an important forum at Government House in Hobart today. Our reporter, Fiona Breen, is there with details. G'day, Fiona.
Hi, Tony. Yes, there's some amazing people here and some really interesting stories. I've got a couple of people that have joined me here at Government House that I thought I'd bring to the Country Hour because there's just some fantastic information and some fantastic partnerships between Tasmania, for example, and some countries overseas. So I've got Dr. Stephen Ives here. He's a research fellow with the Tasmanian Institute of Agriculture. And I've also got one of his colleagues, Dr. Ha, who is here from Vietnam. They've been working together on a pretty interesting program that spanned a few years, about 10 years, which involves Vietnam and Tasmania. I thought I'd ask them about it. Dr. Stephen Ives, thanks for joining the Country Hour.
Oh, thanks, Fiona. Thanks for having me.
Now, you've got quite a history with Vietnam, having gone there with your family, was it 10 or more years ago?
2011, actually. We went there for a year.
And so your background here, you've sort of got people more involved in agriculture in Vietnam and sort of trying to get in entry level, I suppose, to get the whole family interested. Tell me about it.
Well, I guess that wasn't the original intention, but it was to give them an experience in country so that when we did come back to Australia and when I travelled overseas, they knew what I was on about. So it wasn't so hard for them to say, oh, that's where Dad's going, that's what he's doing. Yeah.
Now, what were you involved in? What was the research you were trying to do in partnership with your colleagues in Vietnam?
I was looking at constraints of livestock production in the highlands of Vietnam, where they have similar sort of conditions to Tasmania, which is surprising. People think that it's always hot in Vietnam, but it's...
You mentioned a couple of direct similarities.
Well, it was really the remoteness, the isolation that areas in the northwest highlands of Vietnam face, and similar to what often Tasmanian farmers face as well.
Okay, and also, I mean, I think there were some... There were also temperature similarities and a few things even like that that people might be surprised about.
Absolutely. So it was really, but I guess the main difference is the winter was cold, but it was also damp. And so with a wind chill factor of minus 10, you get similar sort of contrast that you do in Tasmania.
So how were you sort of connecting with those farmers?
It was really through our partnerships with our institutions, the institutions we worked with in Vietnam, with the National Institute of Animal Science and Vietnam National University of Agriculture. So we actually worked together. It wasn't us going and saying, this is how you do things. It was actually working together, and together we're finding solutions.
What sort of solutions were you working on for farmers in Vietnam?
It was really around how they would help produce their food more efficiently, but also more consistently, and improving the quality of the feed. It's all very well to improve the genetics of animals, but if they don't have the proper food, well, you're not going to get very far. So it was working with our partners in Vietnam to work with the farmers, but working with the farmers through the Extension Service, because the Extension Service are really important because they have the day-to-day connection with the farmers.
What do you mean the Extension Service?
So the local... every district or every province has almost like a what is, I guess, happens in Australia through consultants who actually work directly with farmers. So we actually work across a number of people that have the day-to-day contact. We're there on occasion, but you need people that are actually there all the time, and they need to be part of that partnership.
It took you a while to get the trust and of the farmers, and how did you go about doing that?
Well, I guess it was interesting because that's where... inadvertently having my family there, because they would often say, so are you going tomorrow? And I said, well, actually, no, I live here now. Oh, okay. So, and then I think that certainly built the trust quicker than what might have otherwise happened. Otherwise, it does take a little while just for them to know that you're there to help, not to command or not to tell. You're there to help and to work with them.
Okay, now, Dr. Ha, you've been involved in this program. Tell me what your observations were.
All right, thank you, Fiona. So we have lots of observations, and we can see the significant development in the communities, the local communities, through the ACR-funded projects. We have seen the beef cattle farmers can grow cattle better and more. They can even grow more cattle in a shorter periods of time. So in the past, they used to keep cattle for 10 years or even more, and they didn't want to sell cattle. Now they want to sell some.
Now, why didn't they want to?
Because they see the economic values out of that, and also they can see that is an opportunity to send children to schools and also to pay for some of their living necessaries.
So was it sort of the cultural thing to keep their cattle as something they might want to earn money off later if they had an emergency or something?
That's right. You get to the core of the problems. This is the values, the traditional values, to keep cattle, and see cattle as kind of an asset to show to the other villagers that I'm rich and as I have something to show you. And now this is time for them to think about now what we can do with the cattle. How can we make this more commercialized? Of course, it's not very popular to all of the villagers, but it's getting better, like the awareness of the community is getting better.
So it's getting more awareness culturally that it's okay to sell your cattle on, to exchange back and forth cattle, to get some funds, regular funds.
That's right, yep. And then this is also the chance for them to learn from other farmers as well, because when they want to grow bigger cattle and having more cattle, they have to learn from the extensionists and also to learn the experience from better farmers, like good farmers.
What are the cattle like over there? Are they similar to any of the breeds here? Or
No. The local breed is what we call the yellow cattle. So it's actually very small, and some of them are hybrid, like with the scenes from India's bred. So this is about 300 to 500 kilogram cattle. So it's comparatively small, relatively small, to the Western cattle.
Is it good for meat, or what do they sell it on for?
So this will be the other aspect of the market preferences, the taste. So the smaller cattle is actually very tender and have a strong taste.
Very tender, did you say? Okay.
And it's like... we say this is kind of a sporty cattle, so they walk a lot and do a lot of exercise. It's not just like the cattle here in Tasmania.
Not like the fat cattle here in Tasmania that don't walk around a lot.
Yeah. And they cook different kind of dishes, stir fries, and also different kind of additionals ingredients in cooking those.
So they're not likely to have a slab of beef. They're more likely to have smaller amounts in their cooking or whatever.
Sure, yeah.
Okay. Coming back to Dr. Ives, I'll give
Professor's
you
a... Professor's fine. Yeah, that's professor. Fine. Aspirational.
Now, you went back to Vietnam in 2022 with your son. What did you notice had been the changes?
Just the change in attitude. I think with people not being able to communicate as effectively. Mind you, our partners, we had such good relationships with our partners that the work continued while we were away, because even the distance between 2011 and when we couldn't travel in 2020, I would be travelling to Vietnam three or four times a year. So I had that big gap. Going back in 2022, seeing how the baton had been passed on. So really, they were continuing the work and I was just turning up and saying, great job.
That's what you want.
And it's exactly what you're looking for.
Okay, yeah. Dr. Stephen Ives and Dr. Ha from Vietnam, from which university?
So back in Vietnam, my university is the Vietnam National University of Agriculture.
Okay, thank you so much for joining the Country Hour.
Thanks, Fiona.
Thank you, Fiona.
And that's Fiona Breen reporting there from Government House on the forum being hosted by the Crawford Fund, doing well by doing good. And I can remember reporting on that particular story many, many years ago. So it's going well. It's fantastic. Well, Tasmanian Irrigation says it's very confident of getting state and federal approval for the new Sassafras Wesley Vale irrigation scheme in the northwest of the state. Tas Irrigation CEO Andrew Kneebone says water sales have been good. The new scheme will triple the amount of water provided to farmers.
It's been through water sales and we got very good demand in that for that region. We're now looking to extend that scheme by a further 9,000 megalitres and take it up to about a close to a 15,000 megalitre scheme. So it's going to triple in size from the existing scheme. That's currently with state government for approval of the business case, and it's with the Commonwealth government for funding.
How much money are you looking at with that one, by the way?
It's about between $120 and $130 million in total project value. And it will effectively completely replace the existing scheme. So we'll have to keep the old scheme running while we build the new scheme. It's a really good result. I think it's a much more flexible design than was originally built down there. So people will be able to trade water a lot more freely and easily than they were able to previously and move their own water around the district. So we've got people there who lease land. And because there's very high crop rotations through that area, they want to be able to have flexibility about owning a block of water in a location but having the opportunity to use it in multiple locations as they have to rotate their crops.
How confident are you that the money will come through both from the state and the feds?
It's within the announced funding, global announced funding amounts for the federal government. So the federal government have committed up to $217 million towards these projects. And so far, they've only funded the Don project. So there's Northern Midlands and Sassafras that they've got business cases and funding submissions for. Both of those fit within that $217 million of committed funding. The state has committed $108.7 million, and that's also close enough, close to covering the cost of those of the Northern Midlands and the Sassafras Wesley Vale schemes. There's an amount of money that the state government's having to consider over and above their current commitment, but they're looking at that in this budget process, and we'll find out in the May budget as to whether or not that we've been successful.
Okay, and if you are successful from both state and federal governments, when realistically will the new scheme be in operation, do you think?
Off the top of my head, Tony, I haven't looked at this one, but I believe we're looking at probably in 2 years' time.
Yeah, that's Tasmanian Irrigation CEO Andrew Kneebone with an update of the expanded Sassafras Wesley Vale Irrigation Scheme. It's going to triple the amount of water provided to farmers covered by that scheme. And at the moment, it's with the state and federal governments for funding. Okay, it is Friday afternoon and time to head out to the livestock markets and check what's been happening with Richard Bailey. How are you, Richard?
Good afternoon, Tony. Travelling well. Nice bit of rain around during the week, which is the talking point of everyone at the sale yesterday. Certainly the northwest and northeast and northern Midlands certainly ended up around about 40 or 50 mils and Fingal Valley. But then you get down a little bit further and it wasn't quite as good as that. I think around Bothwell was more sort of around that 15 mils, maybe 20 in places, and further south the same. So, but still very, very good. And in parts, one of the northeast blokes was telling me yesterday that they've had 50 mils for the month. So that's, things are looking very good up there and up the north, far northwest. And as I said, through a lot of the northern Midlands. So that's really set things up. Talking to a Victorian agent yesterday, and he was saying that they are still in need of rain in Victoria, although they have in the last 24 hours had a bit more rain. Parts of New South Wales are good, parts need rain. So if you're a Tasmanian and wondering why we worry about Victorian and New South Wales rainfall, it sort of affects the whole of the livestock industry.
Yep.
Because we're so reliant on what happens over there.
The big story yesterday, the Herefords were up for sale at the Wiener sale. How'd they go?
Yeah, we had 2,320 elders had their, what they call their feature Hereford sale. She said, worked out with the numbers, it was about 42% Hereford, 35% Angus, and 17% Black Baldies, and then a few others. So although it was a Hereford feature sale, there were certainly other cattle there as well. There was a magnificent lineup of Hereford steers in the front row. and they sold accordingly, probably per kilo the best of the autumn. We saw the calculator at a couple of times down that front row got over 500 cents. Well, it's a fair while since we've seen that for those heavier steers this autumn. $1,240 to $2,020 a head to average $495. The next run down, $1,020 to $1,600 to average $420. And lighter, $900 to $1,360 to average $435. Over in the heifers, the heavier heifers, there was a wide range here because there were a couple of pens of Herefords that were bought to be breeders. They topped at $1,740 a head, but most of those heavier ones went anywhere from $900 to $1,700. Next run down, $880 to $1,100 to average $3.30. And then the next run down, between 200 and 280 kilos, they averaged around 380 cents a kilo and at times nudged 400 cents. So they were probably the pick per kilo of the heifers. They made $680 to $1,300 and then very small, $550 to $630 a head. I don't think there were any went out, which indicates that we're right up there with the Victorian sales. In fact, that was verified by the Elders boss who was down yesterday. He just said that, you know, we're certainly there or in places a little bit dearer than the interstate sale, so that's good news. Still on cattle, Tony, couple of bull sales during the week. Woodburn had their Murray Grey sale and Dunrowan had their Shorthorn sale. Both of them had full clearances, which is, you know, very, very good because, that you know, you don't want bulls hanging around for too long. And averages were very good. I think the Woodburn average was very similar to last year. So that was excellent. Hereford bull sales, well, the two Quambie and Guildford bull sales the week after Easter, that'll sort of tidy up most of the bull sales for the autumn and then we end up in the spring for the next lot. Couple of dates that people might want to just sort of keep in mind. We've got two weaner sales next month, one Nutrien on the 20th and Elders on the 27th. That will sort of tidy up the weaner sales. We then go back in May to the normal monthly store sales. And obviously on the 25th, being Anzac Day, which is a Tuesday, there won't be a normal sale at Piranha. Another little note I've just got here too is that with the bull sales right through the autumn, Auctions Plus has been used a lot to either view and or bid on bulls. So that's pretty interesting that seems to have been out of the COVID situation, seems to have stayed around there.
Yeah. Okay. Now, the cattle market on the mainland, any big news there?
No, not really. They're waiting on rains. I think, if anything, they're sort of a little bit cheaper in a lot of places. You know, there's a lot of yearlings only making 300 to 360 cents a kilo. It takes a very good yearling or veeler to get over 400 cents a kilo in the yards. Cow market's holding up pretty well, and I think that's because the lean beef job in the US has improved a bit over the last month, so that probably gives the exporters a little bit more incentive to push in there. So yeah, no, just hanging along. Numbers, they're saying that numbers, well, certainly the slaughter numbers are high, way higher than they were this time last year. But you've got to factor into that this time last year we were still struggling with labour shortages through all the abattoirs. So, yeah. But we are a lot higher slaughter-wise, and so in the yards and direct to works there are more cattle around, which you'd expect because we've had a good 3 years' worth of rebuilding. So that's sort of expected.
Okay, now lamb and sheep.
Okay, the lamb market's showing some signs of a little bit of resurrection, particularly, and that once again, it's the well-finished heavy lambs that are attracting. Bendigo, there weren't a lot on Monday, but at Ballarat on Tuesday, Hamilton on Wednesday, and Wagga yesterday, a lot of these better lambs are now sort of averaging anywhere from 700 to 750 cents, and there were some good quality trade lambs in that sort of 24 to 26 bracket, kilo bracket, that nudged up towards $8 a kilo. So that's good news on that. But as we've said now for some months, once they're unfinished, they're very quickly down to 550, 600 cents a kilo. There's a big difference. You know, like we're talking $20, $30, $40 a head, same weight, but not finished. So there's a big gap there. And one would imagine that's going to stay like that for a while. A little bit hard to tell. And then the mutton market also showed a bit of improvement later in the week, particularly. A lot of mutton now, sort of 350 to 400 cents a kilo. So that's come off that 250 to 300 cents that we were talking, you know, over the last 3 months, I suppose. So I suppose the talking point of the week really has been the rain.
Yeah. Fantastic. All right, Richard, you have a great weekend.
Will do, Tony.
Yeah, the rain, definitely. And Richard Bailey will be back on the country our next Wednesday afternoon to check that latest Power in a Sale. Don't forget, if you're looking for something to read over the weekend, have a look at. ABC Rural Online is the place to go, or ABC Rural Facebook page. That new apple variety, the story is up on our ABC Rural page. There's also a video on Instagram as well. Look up new apple variety Huon Valley. And don't forget the Facebook page. Have a happy and safe weekend, whatever you're doing. We'll catch you after midday Monday.